Today, not pretty. Household finances under the microscope. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, that's post covering finance and property news. Today, I want to walk through some of the latest analysis that we've done from our surveys and also set it in context, a broader context of how households are faring at the moment. And frankly, the story is not that good. And just before we get into the details today, I will say that on Tuesday in my live stream, I'm going to go even deeper and discuss specific postcodes. So if you want to know how households are faring at a specific postcode level, then join me on Tuesday where you can ask live for a specific postcode analysis. And of course, in that particular analysis, we can go into significant detail looking at mortgage stress, dynamics on prices, the mix of property, investment returns, and all sorts of other things at a postcode level. But today, what I want to do is to set in context that Tuesday show. And a good place to start, I think, is this article, which actually, from Michael Reed, makes the point that Australian living standards have not increased at all over the past year and are barely higher than they were 10 years ago, which, of course, is a challenge to Albanese, who's now kicked out the election until May. This is based on analysis from the National Accounts, which showed that gross domestic product per person did increase for the first time in 2 years in the December quarter, as quarterly growth hit a post-pandemic high of 0.6%. But the problem is that despite the uptick last quarter, real income per person is actually slightly lower than a year ago, and only 1.5% higher than it was a decade ago. That's the weakest 10 years growth since records began in 1983, according to analysis by the AFR from the ABS data. Interestingly, independent economist Chris Richardson said that the stage three tax cuts on July 1 had done less to boost real incomes than he'd originally expected. One of the main reasons is bracket creep, because bracket creep arises because tax thresholds are fixed in dollar terms and not indexed. So as workers' wages increase, a great proportion of their pay is pushed into the highest tax bracket applicable to them, meaning the average tax rate increases over time. Now, it's interesting that CBA economist Gareth Aird says that real household disposable income had picked up over the second half of 2024 because of falling inflation and the income boost from stage three tax cuts. But it's important to note that real household disposable income per capita has been through an extraordinary period of weakness due to elevated inflation, rising tax paid as a share of incomes because of bracket creep and the big lift in interest rates. And in fact, as Jonathan Kearns points out, the only route out of this is to improve productivity, which is actually an interesting challenge, as we'll see, given the mix of jobs and who's paying for them. Now, it's true to say also that the massive stimulus, about $400 billion plus through COVID, went towards households and they did increase their savings, but that's disappeared as well. So the net bottom line is that households are very much up against it. And frankly, all the government spin of significant wealth improvement through to income growth is only a small part of the story. Sure, incomes have risen just slightly, but firstly, the top line numbers are improved because of very significant migration, which means that you have to look at the per capita numbers to get a real story. And also the fact that, of course, interest rates have come back, well, maybe a tad, but, well, there's still a significant road back. And, of course, households have much bigger mortgages these days than before. So the takeout from this analysis is simple. Households are in significant pressure at the moment, and I see that in my surveys. And just to re-emphasize that, the ABS published on Friday household spending data, which showed that in current prices, season adjusted, it dropped back. In fact, the ABS said that in January 2025, household spending rose 0.4% month on month in current price adjusted basis and rose 2.9% compared to January 2024. And interestingly, analysis showed that health was up by 2.5%, goods and services up 1.2%, and transport were up 1%. Now, we can break that out between goods and services. And they showed that household spending on goods fell 0.6% month on month, driven by decreased spending on purchase of vehicles, cigarettes and tobacco, furniture, floor coverings and household goods. On services, services spending rose 1.5% month on month, driven by increased spending on rail and transport, total health services, air passenger and sea transport. Another way to look at it is both from a discretionary and essential perspective too. And in season-adjusted terms, discretionary spending fell 0.2% month on month, driven by a decreased spending on purchase of vehicles, cigarettes, tobacco and furniture, floor coverings and household goods, whereas non-discretionary spending rose 1.4% month on month, driven by increased spending on rail and road transport, total health services, motor vehicle repairs, maintenance and miscellaneous expenditure. So the point I want to make here is that whilst the top line is improving simply because of the bigger number of people, if you look at it on a real household basis, things are not that flash. Now, another way of looking at this is where the growth in employment has come from. And this article just highlights the fact that 3 in 4 new jobs over the last year were paid for by taxpayers. Now, Michael Reed makes the point that about 1 in 3 of the 487,000 jobs created in 2024 were in the public sector, according to analysis by the AFR Weekend. The public sector includes anyone directly employed by governments, including public servants, nurses, and teachers. About 15% of workers nationally are in the public sector, meaning the growth in government employment in 2024 was disproportionately strong. And the hiring meant public sector employment grew by 7.3% in 2024, well above the private sector, which expanded at just 2.4%. AMP economist Shane Oliver makes the point that that has crowded out, effectively, private sector activity. And the government roles are even broader when examining the so-called non-market sector, which includes health, education, public administration. While most workers in the non-market sector work for private employers, for example, 90% of healthcare employees are in the private sector, the industries themselves are primarily financed by governments. In fact, 3/4 of the 487,000 jobs filled over the past year were in the non-market sector, including 234,000 in health, 72,000 in education, and 67,000 in public administration and safety. As a result of this, productivity across the non-market sector fell by 3.2% over the past year and is now roughly the same level as it was in March 2001. And of course, it's true to say that these jobs are important, but as Shane Oliver makes the point, it doesn't necessarily contribute to productivity growth, and we are, in a way, chasing our own tails. So you can see here that government policy has led to a further deterioration in productivity, which of course leads to lower wages, which leads potentially to more pressure on households. And he makes the point that if you're going to get serious about getting productivity growth up, we have to find ways to limit growth in the public sector employment relative to the private sector. The strength of jobs growth in the non-market sector means it now accounts for 30% of total employment, up from 27% in 2022. And of course, a significant chunk of that is in the $49 billion National Disability Insurance Scheme, which until recently was growing by 20% per year. And employment in the aged care sector is also growing rapidly. One other quick perspective here is a report that shows that extreme rental crises has meant that in some parts of Sydney, it's now cheaper to own a home than to rent one. Although actually in our analysis, we are still seeing that most people are paying more for a mortgage in most areas relative to rents. And it's interesting that this article suggests that with interest rates dropping, maybe people would be better to ditch renting and become homeowners. That, of course, is if you can get a mortgage. So with that context, let me just quickly now tell you a little bit about our analysis, which of course runs from our surveys. They run all the time, 52,000 households, and we get this data back weekly and report at the end of each month. So we're looking at information here to the end of February. We can slice and dice the data lots of different ways, and we can also form a view as to where property prices may move thanks to our scenarios. If you think about it, we can take our mortgage stress data, the price trajectory in history, the buying and selling intentions, the migration data, the economic information, and put it all into the core market model through our scenarios and calculate at a postcode level and roll it up to a region, state and all Australia level, and also form a view of where prices may go ahead. Oh, and by the way, if you would like to have a one-to-one conversation about a particular suburb, we do offer that service. It's an individual confidential conversation, but it's not financial advice. And we can take our data to look at what's going on down at the suburb level. I can look at the stress, the home price trend data, and extract a view of price trends ahead based on our modelling. We are booking. It takes a little while to do the work. So assuming we have a conversation for about an hour, there is a cost involved as well, because, again, it takes quite a lot of time. And we're booking 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment. I've got quite a few people scheduled over the next few days, simply because a lot of people are trying to work out what's really going on and what might actually be the best strategy from this point forward. Another point to make is we just define stress differently from some others, that they will tend to use 30% of income, although it's not clear whether it's taxable or whether it's gross income. But even if you use underwriting metrics, that may not be very accurate. We use a cash flow piece of analysis, money in, money out. If households have more outgoings, excluding one-off discretionary items and income, we define the stress. If they have a mortgage, they're in mortgage stress. If renting, then they're in rental stress. Investors also could have cash flow pressures, and we can identify them as stressed investors. And so we can aggregate that information to estimate the total financial stress at a postcode level. And we can look at both the percentage of households and the count. I tend to believe that the best way is to look at the rule of big numbers. So where are the largest number of households in difficulty? But percentage also tells us some quite interesting information too. Now, another way to think about the definition, this is actually an RBA chart that shows that on the spectrum of household financial stress, there's mild, where the budget pressures begin to pile in through to missed payments and ultimately insolvency. Insolvency is still quite low at the moment, although the number of small businesses falling over are rising. And the number of people missing payments has gone up a little, but I measure it at the mild end, at the budget pressure end. Is there a pressure on money in, money out? In other words, are households having to make hard decisions about what they spend their money on and forego certain things, for example, healthcare or indeed school fees? Now, looking at the data to February 2025, and this is plotting the trend, you can see there that firstly, rental stress, so those paying rents, 76.9% of households in the rental sector are in rental stress at the moment. That's pretty much holding steady, and it's been rising quite fast since May 2021. The rental stress is very high. Mortgage stress is also high. We're at 50%, and it's been holding at that level consistently for the last few months. And if you go back to pre-COVID levels in February 2020, it was 32.9%. So there's a considerable rise in the proportion of households with a mortgage that have cash flow pressures. But as I said, this is not defaults. This is cash flow pressures, money in, money out. Oh, and by the way, the debt to income ratio remains relatively high according to the RBA data. And this, of course, includes all households, whether they're borrowing or not. The truth is that the debt-to-income ratio is somewhere between 6 to 8 times for most households. So this is the top-level results for February 2025. And you can see there that in the ACT, mortgage stress came down slightly. That's highlighted in blue. But rental stress, investor stress, and financial stress all rose. In New South Wales, mortgage stress, rental stress, and investor stress all rose. So financial stress was higher. In the Northern Territory, investor stress rose. The others slipped back. In Queensland, mortgage stress fell and Rental stress rose along with investor stress, so financial stress in aggregate levels rose. In South Australia, both rental stress and mortgage stress rose, while financial stress slipped slightly. In Tasmania, there was an easing across the board. In Victoria, mortgage stress and rental stress did ease back, but investor stress rose. And in Western Australia, both mortgage stress and rental stress rose. Investor stress fell and financial stress rose. And you can see there that at the bottom, half of those households with mortgages are in mortgage stress. That's more than 1.8 million households. 76.9% of those in the rental sector, or 2.3 million households, are in rental stress. And investor stress at 17.1% is about 500,000 stressed investors. And overall financial stress at 47.6% means that 4.7 million households of the pretty much 10 million households across the country have financial pressure at the moment. Now, let me make the point that 50% in financial stress means the other 50% is doing quite well. And in some cases, those are households without a mortgage, so there are no mortgage payments or housing payments at all to be made, or indeed those with significant incomes or significant investment portfolios, either investment properties or indeed possibly stock market funds. So we are seeing a bifurcation. And in fact, I made a show the other day highlighting the fact that the disproportionate move of wealth towards a section of the community has created a significant disparity. It's a much bigger disparity than previously. So to my mind, the idea that Australia was an egalitarian country may have been true years ago, but it's broken down dramatically thanks to government policy. Now, another way to look at the data is to break it by our different segments. And this also shows here that it's young growing families, first-time buyers, who are under the most mortgage stress, 89.7%. That's more than 288,000 first-time buyers who are struggling. In the rental stress sector, a lot of those, 85% of the first-generation migrants to Australia, the multicultural establishment group, more than 198,000 are in rental stress. And looking at investor stress, in fact, it's exclusive professionals who have the highest proportion of investments in property and young affluents who also have significant investment portfolios that are having difficulty, with around 77,000 exclusive professional investors under pressure and around 57,000 young affluents. And at the aggregate level, financial stress is highest among young growing families at 67.7%. Now, the next thing I'm going to touch on briefly today is our scenarios. Scenarios are a way of exploring different futures and considering the consequences. They're not predictions. They're not forecasts. And if we take our scenarios, the three that we run with at the moment is we have a best case where in the Goldilocks zone, rates stay at 4.1%, then fall later in the year. Inflation eases in line with RBA expectations. Wages rise faster. We don't get a recession, but migration still remains above average, even if it pumps back a little bit. The base case is a soft landing where rates at 4.1%. Inflation falls. We do see some inflation rises up again later, but nevertheless, there is still chances that rates get cut later. And until 2026 stays above target, we don't get a recession in Australia, but migration falls to average. And the worst case is the nightmare scenario where, in fact, we see rates going up again in 2025, which would mean that mortgage rates will stay high. And they stay high in 2026 with inflation, which remains sticky, unemployment rises, wage growth stalls due to recession. And then we obviously get rate cuts later. And meantime, we get significant drops in migration to below average. So they're the three that I run with. You could invent some other ones too, but they give you quite a broad range. And if we apply that then to our home price scenarios, in the best case scenario, we are seeing still house prices rising on average across Australia by around 13% over the next 3 years and by 4.6% over the next 12 months. In the base case, there's a small fall, not significant, but over 3 years, perhaps down 6.1%. And the very worst case, a fall of around 26%. over the next 3 years. Now, my belief is that we're going to see somewhere between the best and the base case, the most likely scenarios for Australia. But we should still bear in mind the risks from black swan events globally of a significant downturn, particularly if the US, I think, went into recession later in the year, which some are now talking about. Units pretty much follow on. Now, within that, it's worth noting that in WA, we've got much stronger expectations for home price growth, 20% over 3 years, best case scenario. Even on the base case scenario, it's pretty much flat. In fact, 2% up over the next 12 months, and then almost nothing after that. The worst case scenario is still a fall, under 20% though, and units following on rather similarly. If we compare that with Queensland, again, strong growth, with an 18.3% rise over the next 3 years, best case, the base case a fall, very small fall, and the worst case a more significant fall. I should say this was done before the latest storm event, and so Albert may have an impact on home prices in Queensland with significant demand perhaps for people moving, and also a lack of supply, so that will have an impact, but too soon to model that yet. Units following on quite close. In South Australia, we again see rises 20% over 3 years. Best case for houses. The base case, pretty much flat. The worst case, a significant fall. And units following on. In New South Wales, there is still an upside to prices, maybe 12.5% over 3 years and 3.9% over 12 months. Base case is a fall of 6.9% over 3 years and a small fall over the next 12 months. And the worst case, a more significant fall. Units following on. The ACT also has a scenario of about 6.7% over 3 years. Best case. The base case, a fall of 12% and a fall of 33.4% over the next 3 years in the worst case scenario. And that assumes a considerable reduction in the number of public servants in and around Canberra. Units follow on as well. And in Tasmania, the best case is a rise of 6.2% over 3 years. The base case a fall of 13%. The worst case a fall of 34% and units following on. And Victoria shows, well, in the best case, a small rise, 4.7% over 3 years. So I still think Victoria is likely to languish relative to other states. Houses. And the best case scenario, small rise, but the base case, a fall of about 14% and a worst case scenario of 35% in units following on. And just for completeness, NT, significant upside or significant downside, depending on what happens with our scenarios. But there are very small volumes of transactions and the supply-demand disequilibrium is harder to detect in the Northern Territory as a result. Units following on though. Now on Tuesday, I'm going into significant detail at a postcode level. If you'd like to ask about a particular postcode, then come on the show or put a postcode in the comments below and I'll try and cover it on the live show on Tuesday. And you can see there that we cover not only the house and unit scenarios, but also the mix of households, those owning outright, borrowing and renting, and those investing, the rental stress, mortgage stress, and investor stress, and overall financial stress, the property mix, and even things like the gross investment and net investment yield, the average taxable income, and also the true disposable monthly income on average at the postcode level, and the proportion going on the mortgage and the rent. This particular one is in Wollongong, and you can see there that the average mortgage in this particular postcode 2500 is $2,467 a month, which is 41.3% of net disposable income. The average rent is a third of disposable income at $1,993 a month. Just before I close, let me say that if you have financial pressures, in particular debt pressures, then consider calling the National Debt Helpline, 1-800-007-007. Be careful not to just Google, because you can get yourself into a situation where people start charging you for advice The National Debt Helpline is government supported, of course, and I do recommend it as a source of help. Another one is the AFCA's Statement of Financial Position, which is a form that you can complete, which allows you to fill out what you earn, what you owe, what your living expenses are, and what you own. And that is a really useful form to, for example, take to your bank if you have an issue, or talk to a financial advisor, or indeed talk to a debt counsellor, because it really puts things down. I quite often find that households don't have a clear view of what their status is, so this is a useful form. Let me finally say that if you are interested in supporting our work, you can do so via Patreon, but also if you want to get hold of the data that I've shared tonight for all the postcodes across the country, that is available. It's $50 a month plus GST, and you can join that over at Patreon. The links there are below and also on the screen. And that's a valuable way of getting detailed information at a postcode level and also supporting what we do. We really appreciate those who support what we do. And you can also support us, by the way, via PayPal as well as a one-off donation. Really appreciate those who do that as well. It all helps to enable us to continue to make the shows that we do. And the fact of the matter is, I don't do this for profit. I do this because I think there's a really, really important conversation to be had. And I make the point, I think, that this is a very relevant conversation to be had now, because the politicians are not telling the true story about what's going on. They, of course, are claiming to be supporting and, you know, helping, but policy failure over several generations, including migration policy, housing policy, and bank lending policy, have also contributed to this diabolical situation where more households are in difficulty. And I think there should be a different discourse ahead of the election than the one we're having at the moment. Let me just remind you again that if you'd like to get on the Tuesday show to do a deep dive on a particular postcode, we've started 8 p.m. Sydney time, and you can put a request in into the chat as we go live, and I'll try and handle it. So I hope you found this show useful, and I look forward to seeing you on the Tuesday live show. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. We'll see you next time.